The Nagging. Naturalist. It's the Nagging Naturalist Podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Nagging Naturalist Podcast. This podcast discusses animals, how they benefit our society and our planet, the threats they face, and what we can do to protect them. I'm your host, Kristen, and I'm a naturalist by trade, and I am recording this the morning after election night. And let me tell you what, I didn't go to bed until like 3 a.m. this morning. I'm exhausted and I'm tired. I'm angry. I'm frustrated. It's one of those things where I knew that this was going to be an issue. I hoped it wouldn't be, but I knew that this was going to be a close race, and it's just really disappointing to see that. I didn't want to be right. I think those of us who knew this was coming didn't want this to be the case, but here we are. As I'm recording this, we still don't know who the president is, and it's such a close race that nobody can truly call it, and it's an incredibly frustrating thing, especially as somebody who's spent so much time advocating for the environment and for wildlife and wanting to protect animals and people. It's very difficult to watch this unfold. I'm sure I'm not the only one in this boat. I know that a lot of people spent a lot of time last night and even this morning have been voicing their frustration over the issues. But I have this final episode to release, and I was originally scared to release it after Election Day, thinking that it would be buried in all of the drama. But I honestly think that this is a good note for me to end on for the year, and I think it's very appropriate for the election. Because towards the end, Simone, who does the takeover, has some really great things to say and some very hopeful messages for the future. And the work she's doing is so important when it comes to educating the next generation on being better stewards of the environment and protecting wildlife. So despite all that's happening right now, I think that for those who need a little flicker of light in this darkness, I think that she might be able to help provide some of this. And for those of you who may be not familiar with Simone, she's actually done a lot of really cool stuff this past year, especially with Shark Week and Elasma Week for the National Aquarium. So there's some really cool videos that are up from those times. So if you look up like Elasma Week 2020, that I think Ms. might have hosted it. They have some recordings of her discussing sharks with really cool people like Jenny Jansen, and just lots of great material. I'll be sure to plug her social media at the end of this, but yeah, if you are looking for some positive messaging in everything that's going on right now, this might just be what you need. So let's go ahead and dive on into this.
All right, cool. Well, then let's go ahead and start off with you, introducing you so that, you know, the people who are listening can get an idea of your background and what's kind of brought you to the place where you are in your life right now and the decisions you've made and the things that you want to discuss. So let's go ahead and get started with that.
Okay, so I'm Simone, and I actually started my work, I guess, and my interest in marine science at the National Aquarium, which is kind of ironic because now I work for the National Aquarium. So when I was younger, I was really into nature and watching, you know, like documentaries and things on Saturday morning. And so I kind of knew that I liked the ocean, but I'd never been to a beach or anything. I didn't go to a beach until, I want to say, like late middle or high school even. And the beach I went to was like Myrtle Beach. That's it. And so I was still really excited to learn more about nature and the ocean. And so when I got to going into my ninth grade year, I was like, you know, you have to do volunteer hours or service learning hours to graduate from high school.
Yeah, the community service.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yep. So the Youth Exhibit Guide program that we still have now allows, you know, students to get hours if they want to be exhibit guides at the aquarium. And so I signed up for that program and participated in it, and it was really fun, and I got to learn about all of the exhibits in the building. I still have this huge binder of all of the like reading material that we had to review, because we had to take like a test to see if we knew the information, because we would be posted in the exhibits, and as people would come through, they would be asking us questions. So we were expected to be familiar with, you know, the exhibits, the habitat, the species that were included, all of those things. And I was a nerd kind of when I was younger, probably still am a nerd. So like, I wanted to read this big, huge textbook and take a test and show that, you know, like, yeah, I know this information. Like, that was fun for me. I loved taking tests, and I miss that actually about school, because I don't get to take tests anymore. And I always, it's kind of like prideful, right? You know, to like answer all the questions, be like, oh, I knew all of those answers. Like, yes, I know this.
Like, I am capable. And
yes,
I would actually love to see that binder compared to like the newest binder, because I imagine if this was years ago, like that was back when we had like Wings in the Water and stuff, mm-hmm. like that. Like it was a completely different aquarium.
Yes, yes, exactly. It. So it was completely different. We even had the seahorse exhibit still, which Aww. Is so cool. It was very different than it is now. The building looked a lot different. You're right. That it was when we had Wings in the Water. So before we had Blacktip Reef. Crazy. So it was really fun. And I loved it. I loved that summer. And I was like, okay, so I know for sure that I want to be a marine biologist. And then I just started to like look into schools that allowed me to study marine biology. When I was in high school, I went to a private school here in Baltimore, St. Paul's School for Girls, and I was definitely the minority in the school. And so I knew that when I went to college that I wanted to go to a historically Black college. And so I went to Hampton for undergrad. And Hampton is actually one of the best HBCUs for marine science. So Hampton's really great for it. So is UMES, University of Maryland Eastern Shore, Savannah State, FAMU even has a great program. So there's some good HBCUs out there that produce marine scientists. And Hampton was my favorite. And so I decided to go to Hampton, and I loved being there. And the department was super small. Like, we just had a handful of us in my class, which was nice because we got to know one another really well, and we got to know, you know, our professors really well, and they got to understand us and understand, you know, what kinds of things we were interested in and where we wanted to, with the next steps that we needed to take. So they were able to mentor us, and that really was helpful, I think. And that's one of the benefits of going to a school where you might be in a smaller department. You know, you do get some additional support. So I really appreciated that. And then, Kristen, I hope that I don't want to talk so much and you don't get to say anything. Let me know if you want to say anything. Just chime in.
Good. I mean, I'm learning a lot because, like, I've known you in, like, I've mostly known you in the professional setting of the aquarium, mm-hmm. where I've been the volunteer and you've worked there. Mm-hmm. And so, like, a lot of this is very new to me. And while I've listened to some of the things that you did, like, during Shark Week and stuff like that, and Elasma Brank Week.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I got quite as much of your background as this in some ways. Like, it was usually skimmed True. Over a little bit. So this is cool going a little bit more in depth. And I totally understand the desire to, you know, go to a school where you're better represented. But also, it is really cool, the idea. Like, I with my school, my school is 100% online even before the pandemic, mm-hmm. because I'm prone to moving. So there is no strong relationship with classmates or professors for me. I'm not going to a campus. I'm not seeing people in person and forming relationships with them. And so I'm kind of jealous that you had that, because even when I did go to community college where I saw people in person, including, unfortunately, people I knew in high school, I've never really, my classes were huge at the community college, of course. So it's one of those things where it's like, I would have loved to have been basically surrounded by like fellow nerds who had similar yeah. passions and goals as me, because I can't imagine how, you know, helpful that would have been. And it's not like I necessarily regret the path I took, because I like where I am in life, but I do think that if I had been given the opportunity to go to a school where I could have definitely been around more peers like me, I would have been a lot happier with some of my schooling.
Yeah, I feel that. But you get to, you know, make connections in other ways. And I think that it's important, obviously, right, for people to note that there's so many different like ways that you can develop your own community, you know, and even by you doing this podcast, right, like you are able to develop relationships with people and a sense of community. And I think that that's really cool too.
Oh, I love it. I love all the people I've met through the podcast. It's been amazing. And even just like connecting better with people, because I can't see you in person the way I can't see most of these people on my podcast. Right. But at the same time, like this is giving me an opportunity to get to know you better, especially with the limitations of things like COVID, where it's hard to just go out and sit down and have a drink and hang out. Mm-hmm. This is a much safer way for the two of us to connect. And it's just so weird, the idea that you're a few blocks away from me right now,
right?
Recording in another house.
Yes, literally. Yes. That's so funny. Yeah, that's hilarious. So Hampton, right? I was there and I was able to get a scholarship called the NOVA EPP Undergraduate Scholarship. So it's the Educational Partnership Program, and it's for students who attend minority-serving institutions in a NOAA-related major. So marine science obviously qualified as like a NOAA-related major or discipline. So I was able to get that scholarship, which includes money towards your tuition, but also two paid internships in the summer from your sophomore year going into your junior year, and then your junior year going into your senior year. So that was like fantastic, you know, because I got two paid internships and money to go towards my tuition. And it was kind of all set. Like I just had to, you know, maintain my GPA. So that was a really great experience. It allowed me to, you know, be introduced to NOAA and all of the great things that folks do in NOAA. I got to meet NOAA scientists, right, and visit labs. And so that was fantastic. And during that time, that was when I first studied sharks during my second internship under that program. And so I was able to, so my main project that particular summer was actually on blue crabs. It wasn't about sharks, but the professor that I was working with, Dr. Richard Brill from VIMS, he was also doing work on sharks. And so he allowed me to, you know, spend some time to learn about that project. And they were really looking at if electropositive metals can deter sharks from like fishing gear. So trying to, it was really, and it's so, you know, it's so funny when you like say things like that and it sounds like, oh, that sounds nice and fancy. But the setup was literally like a pool in a room with a hook that had like a magnet close to it. And you got to see the shark bed close to the magnet. Like, that's it.
Oh, well, I mean, for me, it's mostly the principle of it. Cause I know that there's been a lot of debate about like what people can do to be safer, because a lot of, especially in places like Australia, like they have some pretty controversial ways to keep sharks away from the beaches.
Yeah.
And I know that they've experimented with people wearing certain kinds of like bracelets and gear as deterrents. And I've looked somewhat into it, but because it seems like the success is mixed, I never get like super invested in anything, but it always sounds really interesting just knowing what a shark's physiology is like and hearing something like metal that is magnetized or something that helps act as a deterrent does sound really interesting, even if the presentation isn't exactly like jaw-dropping.
Right. So you're right. Like, you know, that the results are mixed. And I think that that's why it is hard for, you know, scientists to come out with a more sure way for people to protect themselves from sharks, right? So even in our study, or their study, really, it wasn't even mine, I was just there. Even in their study, we started to see that, you know, over time, the shark got used to it and they were like, okay, like, I don't care anymore. But in the beginning, they were swimming towards it and they would turn around. They wouldn't continue to approach the fishing hook. But then as time went on, it got used to it. And it also varies, right, depending on like which shark species you have, the size of the shark. So we were only doing that with sandbars. And so I'm sure that they have still continued this work and have branched out to try with other species. So look up Dr. Richard Brill and Peter Bushnell, because that's what they were working on. And it was pretty cool. That was my first time like going out in a boat and catching sharks and handling them and, you know, feeding them and all of these things. It was really cool. I always thought that, you know, I thought that I would be able to do something like that, but never like actually believed that I would, which sounds kind of crazy, you know, because yeah, I want to, you know, be up close and personal with sharks. I want to, you know, study them, but I never thought that I would actually be doing it. And so at that time I was like, wow, Simone, like you were really doing something that you like dreamed about. And that I thought was so powerful, right? To like see things that you've dreamed about come true. That was awesome.
Oh yeah. I can relate to that. I remember when, what was it? Our local ASAC chapter set up the field trip to do the osprey banding that we do. Well, I don't know about this summer, but typically, especially in the Jug Bay area, we have those usual osprey trips that are open to the public. And, you know, that's where I have one of my favorite pictures of I'm not even like a huge bird person in general, but I was absolutely ecstatic to be handling birds and to be banding them and learning about the process and what people, it's one of those things where like, I expect as somebody who's becoming a wildlife educator to have some experience handling and doing these things. Like, I feel like that's like a default experience a lot of us get, but to be in that moment with the animal up close and personal, touching it, connecting with it and learning more about it, it's almost as much spiritual as it is educational in a way. So I completely understand like how, even though we expect to have those experiences, it can still be one of the most amazing things that we feel like we've ever done.
Yes, right, exactly. So fast forward, I guess, to graduate school, when I went to grad school and studied sharks. And it's funny, it goes kind of right back to what I was saying about, you know, my professors knowing, you know, who I am and what I'm interested in. And they encouraged me to go to graduate school because they knew a guy who was studying sharks that was still kind of in their area, you know, still in the Chesapeake Bay region, I guess, or close to it. So I went to Delaware, actually, and that was really fun for me because I was able to kind of take my the skills that I learned that in that last internship and apply them to my graduate work. So I worked on sand tiger and sandbar sharks, and really, really my work was initially focused on sand tigers. It was really around building a conservation plan for sand tiger sharks because they're a species of concern. And so the goal was to get some insight from anglers about how they perceive sharks and, you know, if they understand how to handle them, if they even know about the regulations that are in place and if they can identify sharks, you know, all of these things that will better help us to know if and, you know, what kinds of regulations need to be put in place to better protect the sharks. And so it was really fascinating. We did the angler survey and we found that while, you know, a lot of the anglers say that they don't always target the sharks, they usually end up catching them anyway, which is sometimes maybe not the most honest, because if you are, you know, kayaking out bait late at night, right, fishing from shore, and you know you're putting out these huge chunks of bait, I mean, you know you're going to get a shark, right? So, and you also know that the sharks that you're going to get are the ones that might be, that usually live near shore, like the sand tiger, for example. But if you also are up on the regulations that are in place, the protections that are in place, you know that sand tigers are protected. So you shouldn't be engaging with them at all. So, you know, it's kind of, you don't want to, and the work that we did was really about, like, you know, not pointing fingers, but recognizing and communicating to the anglers, like, all right, you know, how can we better help you to understand why we have these regulations in place? Because it seems that you know what's out there. You know that you're going to catch sand tigers when you go fishing, you know, in the evenings or at night. And you know where they are because you frequent this area. You know, you come fishing here all the time. You know you're going to find them. But we need you to understand, like, why we don't want you to be engaging with them, why we don't want you to be catching them and and how to handle them when you do, because even NIMS, they had put out, you know, some guidance around how to, like, what kind of hooks to use even. So circle hooks are definitely preferred. But with sand tigers, this is interesting. With sand tigers, because they have this gulp feeding mechanism and they can, like, swallow prey whole, a lot of times they get hooked in the gut, even with a circle hook. So circle hooks usually are effective at hooking a shark in the jaw, but not for sand tigers. And those are one of the species that people frequently catch in Delaware. And so we really wanted to work on a way to try to minimize the harm to sand tigers. And so we used some of the technology that Captain Mark Sampson created. It's like a blocker rig. And I talked about this in Elasmo Week a little bit, but there's like a piece of PVC basically that you attach to the gangin, and that helps to prevent the shark from swallowing it whole. So when they do go to bite, because of the size of the PVC, they can't get their mouth around it. Yeah, super simple, right? Like a piece of PVC, whoa. But it was able to be really effective. And we did not see the gut hooking in the sand tigers when we used that gear. So that was fantastic. And so my work was really around, you know, looking at the perceptions of anglers and at, you know, how we can minimize harm to shark species. And I brought in sandbars because we often caught sandbars as well when we were fishing for sand tigers. And so we ran the blocker study with the sandbars, and the sandbars were fine. They were always hooked in the jaw. So there was no gut hooking.
And I can imagine what a struggle that is too, because I do find that part of the narrative we struggle with in wildlife management is that sometimes hunters and anglers feel like certain regulations are arbitrary and that mm-hmm. just there to like be controlling, when yeah. it's like, no, I promise there's science behind this. While you may not directly experience what we're talking about, and therefore it's hard to understand why we put it there, we promise there's a reason why we did this. And that's not to say that the science is always 100% perfect,
right? But
you shouldn't necessarily just outright dismiss it either.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the anglers, you know, said in their survey that they that they like didn't think that there were like declining numbers or that there was any reason to be concerned about the populations because they catch them so often. So like there's this misconception that just because, you know, you catch these sharks, that means that there are plenty of them out there. So, you know, they're thriving. And there's a misconception that, like, if you let a shark go after you have caught it, you know, that it's fine. But there are, delayed results, and there are delays in, injury that we might see, or delayed mortality even. So there might be a shark that someone catches, and maybe, you know, the shark does get gut hooked. And so they have to cut the line. So the hook stays in the shark. But the shark may swim away. However, that shark can later wash up onto the shore, and then we can find out, you know, that when we open up the shark, that there was a hook that was stuck inside it. And that has happened when we were in Delaware. So I think it's important for the anglers to recognize that, you know, just because the shark swims away, that doesn't mean that it's okay. And the regulations that are in place, the goal is for, you know, us to not have any of those, to reduce the handling to be so minor that we aren't going to see any injury to those animals. Because even, like, we know this about sharks, but especially with sand tigers, right? Like, they don't reproduce. They don't produce that many pups, right? And so we really want to protect all of the ones that they do produce, and each individual, you know?
Yeah, because what is it, like one or two pups
a
year or something?
Yeah, like one or two.
Yeah, very slow reproduction compared to, you know, non-cartilaginous fish. And that's really the case with mm-hmm. all sharks for the most part. There are very few sharks that have more than like a small handful of pups at a time. Like, and yep. your bigger predators are usually only having one or two. I think that, what is it? I think I was surprised to learn, what's the one that it has a spiny dogfish? That's the one that has the mm-hmm. fishery. But that's a shark that's yes. having like a dozen pups at a time.
Yes.
So it's a yeah. completely different dialogue around managing mm-hmm. that population versus, you know, your larger, slower growing, slower reproducing sand tiger.
Exactly. And, you know, that's funny about the sand, about the spiny dogfish. Yes, they definitely have a fishery out there. There's so many dogfish out there. We took in my position now at the aquarium, we take kids on camp. And one of the camps that we went on last year, we were able to have the kids do a dissection of a dogfish, and a lot of them were pregnant, and there were so many pups inside, and like,
oh, wow.
It was really cool though. The kids loved it.
They really loved it. That field trip.
Yeah, it's such a cool camp. I'm so sad we didn't get to do it this year.
Well, hopefully if we're able to put policies in place that, you know, increase the safety for people in the future, we can resume it. But I have to admit, and to my shame, I've actually never dissected an animal. Like in high school, it wasn't a requirement of biology. I didn't dissect frogs. In college, I didn't dissect squids. I actually haven't ever had to. Any dissection I've done has been like me personally just finding dead things and, you know, pulling them apart myself. I've never in an educational or professional setting had to dissect anything. And it's weird to say this as a vegan too, but I actually really want to. It's an experience that I feel like I've missed out on, is being able to. The closest I've gotten is we've got our the Natural History Society of Maryland here in Baltimore. Yeah. I got to help my niece dissect a cow eye last year, and that's about as close as I've gotten to animal dissection.
Wow. Well, you know, you're always welcome to come visit us when we do squid dissections. We aren't doing them right now, but when we resume them, we do squid dissections with students all the time.
Yeah, maybe I will have to pop by the classrooms and do one of those one day.
Yes, for sure. Man. So, went to grad school, did that work, and then got a Knaus Fellowship. So that's a marine policy fellowship. I was an executive fellow, and I was placed in NOAA's Office of Education, which was, again, kind of like ironic, or I guess coming full circle, because I had that scholarship, the EPP program, which was from NOAA's Office of Education. So it's always nice. Like, I feel like my life is continuing to just bring things full circle, right? You know, working at the aquarium after, you know, being introduced to the world of marine science as a youth exhibit guide. And then, you know, getting that scholarship and participating in the EPP program in undergrad. And then once I was in the Knaus Fellowship, being in the same office that that creates and manages that program in an undergraduate scholarship. So very cool. I love that. I love every bit of it. And then after my fellowship, I came to the aquarium and am now overseeing the program that the program that first got me interested in marine science, that Youth Exhibit Guide program, and lots of other ones. So it's been really fantastic. I think that my story is one that really is about, you know, not closing yourself off, because I didn't initially plan to even go to graduate school right when I finished undergrad. I wasn't going to do that. I hadn't planned to work at the aquarium either. I was like, I am not working at an aquarium. I don't want to do that. And then I learned a little bit more about it and was like, okay, I can get with this, you know? So it's really about, you know, just being open to the possibilities. And I'm always about, you know, like giving back, and that's what I get to do now. So love it.
And that is awesome. And especially here in Baltimore, mm-hmm. It's one of those things where the harbor is accessible, but it's also not accessible. Like, yeah. People can come and visit it, but you can't do things in the harbor the way you would at a beach. And this is a reminder. I'm pretty sure I brought this up in my first episode, but this is a reminder to the people of Chicago that you should not swim in our harbor.
Yes, please don't.
Yeah, that was my very first experience when I first moved to Baltimore and I was living in the downtown area. And I, like, the very first news article that went across my dashboard for Baltimore was people, like, tourists from Chicago jumping into our very not safe harbor water. And, you know, that's kind of the problem is, you know, there's so much cool life in there. I've actually seen a baby cow nose ray in the harbor before.
Wow.
Yeah, I was in shock. I was walking around at, like, 10 o'clock at night downtown, and I was walking past the little pirate boat yeah. that you can rent, and I just watched it swimming along. It was maybe like a foot and a half across in its fin span, and I was like, oh my god,
that's amazing. Yeah. There are so many things that live in the harbor, like so many, and people have no clue. And it's crazy. You know, like we run that program literally called What Lives in the Harbor for Baltimore City sixth grade students to come down and learn about what lives there. And they're always shocked when they see like the eel or, you know, striped blenny or the mud crabs or even barnacles. If they see the barnacles, they're like, whoa, what is that? I'm like, yes, I love this. Mussels even, you know, it's so exciting for them. And I love to see how they, even in that moment, they're with us for, you know, 3 hours. But, you know, in just that time frame, they now have learned, you know, a little bit more about wildlife in your own backyard. Like, you don't have to go, you know, to this beach to see these fish. You don't have to go, you know, to an island. Like, you can come here and learn that these things exist in your city, right? That everyone's been talking, you know, this week and last week about the jellies, right, in the harbor.
Yeah, we're finally getting those Atlantic sea nettles now that the weather's dried out and the water's a little saltier.
Yep. So everyone's been talking about that. There's been articles posted, you know, everyone's taking pictures. And we're like, we see jellies here often, though.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember being one of those people, too, because I've lived off and on in Maryland for over 15 years now. And I've only really started to appreciate the diversity of the wildlife since coming back from California back in 2016, when I was initially down in Southern Maryland and then moved up to Baltimore. I saw like lion's mane jellies in the waters mm-hmm. down in Southern Maryland, and I got really excited. And since being up here, you know, I've experienced so much. I was in shock the first time I did one of the bio huts and there were American eels. I'm sitting here like, my experience with American eels in an aquarium setting is they're insanely sensitive to water quality. So I'm sitting here watching this very sensitive animal living
in the harbor.
Yeah. Like this infamous harbor known for its, you know, bacterial problems and all that stuff. And it's just, I was in shock. And I think even the second or third time I saw a bio hut, the water was a little fresh and we caught a pumpkin seed fish.
Yes. Yes. They're in there too. Yes.
It's amazing. And I was just in shock. I was like, how are these living here? And it's been incredible for me. And I'm in my 30s. So mm-hmm. I'm sitting here like, you know, this is phenomenal. And I remember all the conversations now I've been having with people who are like, they might see somebody like fishing in the Inner Harbor and they're like, what do they expect to catch? And I'm like, they can catch a lot, actually. They can catch, you know, depending on the water quality and the season, menhaden, striped bass, sunfish.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so it's been a journey learning about the harbor and all the amazing animals that live in it, despite everything that's wrong with it. It's incredible what nature does in these spaces.
Yes, isn't it? It is. It truly is. I love it. I kind of wish that we had got to, you know, do some more work in the harbor this year. We just didn't because of COVID, you know. So I'm looking forward to when we do, because I really want to see what animals we have in there right now. Like, you know, has it changed at all? Because I did pull up one of the, so we definitely have the bio huts, the large ones that you're talking about. But for the What Lives in the Harbor program, we have like our own smaller habitat cages that we've kind of built, and we put them into the harbor. And they are really just from like a milk crate that we put oyster shells in. Uh-huh. And so we did pull up some of them in the maybe like late summer, and we didn't see a whole lot. And we were trying to figure out why that is, you know, and I don't think that we necessarily had the answer. And so I think we're going to try to pull them up again just in, you know, the next couple of weeks before the weather gets too cold and see what we find. But it's been very interesting. And you're right, that there's so much biodiversity in that harbor. And like, think about the great blue heron that we see. I don't know if it's the same one, but I always see this great blue heron that's in the area, and it's so amazing.
Yeah, actually, speaking of herons, I noticed, like, usually we have a lot of the night herons that come into the Inner Harbor, mm-hmm. and this year, I saw virtually none compared to previous years, and I'm not sure if part of it is because they removed those floating wetlands that were in front of the World Trade Center, which was a really great place for them to hunt, although they still do use the ropes and stuff, but I don't know if with COVID I don't know if it was because of the drastic change in people's presence that changed the harbor and availability, or if because early in the summer it was pretty wet, which meant the water was fresher. And I do notice we tend to have not as many fresher water residents as we do the brackish ones. So when it's like brackish, we see a little bit more of a diversity boom. And the menhaden came late this year. So I don't know if the late menhaden meant that the herons was elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I don't know either, because you're right. We definitely do see the night herons. And I would see the the blue herons, like maybe I would see them often. And I would still get excited every time I saw them. And, you know, it's never like, oh, you've seen one, you've seen them all. I'm always like, oh, oh my gosh. Even though I just saw you yesterday.
No, I get it. Like, especially living next to Patterson Park, I had a blast this year with the bird diversity because I knew that we had a pair of green herons that always nest there. But this year I saw at least two pairs of green herons nesting. There was the one blue heron that always visits. There were at least three night herons every given day during the summer. And then a yellow crown night heron actually did pop by in the early summer, which I had never seen in Patterson Park before. So seeing the yellow crown night heron was really exciting. So I was in shock, because those are the night herons we get around here. We don't really see the little blues or the tricolored herons, which are, I believe, the only other two types of herons in Maryland. But getting 5 out of the 7 herons in one place in the city, for me, is pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's super incredible. I agree. I totally agree. Wow. So, all right, Kristen, I feel like that's my story.
A very abridged version of your story, because I know you've got probably a million really awesome stories to tell, but you know, I can only make a podcast, so
right
I'll just have to make sure I invite you back later.
Of course.
Well, then let's go ahead and talk a little bit more about what you're doing now, and especially in the age of COVID and the pandemic, there's been a lot of struggles with, you know, not just connecting with nature, but how we interact with nature, not outside, but in our own homes. And so, you know, I definitely have seen, especially in Patterson Park, when I try to pick up garbage, like a lot more of the disposable masks and gloves and things like that, like all this additional trash that didn't exist before, because we went from pushing for that more reusable things to suddenly reusable things were unhygienic and dangerous to have during the pandemic. And suddenly we're seeing this huge uptick in disposable things and trash. And it's just, it's been a time. It's been a time to be alive.
True. It has. And you're right. You know, I definitely have seen so many masks like on the ground. And what I do is I don't even know how many of my like reusable masks, like, you know, my fabric masks. I have a couple of them that people have like made for me and that I use regularly. I just wash them like every day in between. But because I have like 4 of them, I'm able to kind of rotate through. And so that's also been really good for me. I've seen a video of someone making a mask like from a sock.
Wow.
So, like, not a sock that I don't think that they wore, but even if they did, if they washed it, I don't think it's a big deal. But I've seen people making masks from, like, even a sock. So there are definitely, like, tutorials and things out there for how you can have your own, like, fabric or reusable mask and use that and being able to make them for yourself. So I love that idea. And then you're right. I also, when I was going to the grocery store, you know, I always try to bring my own bag in grocery stores. I always have bags. Like, I keep bags in my car. I have like a bag that's always on my backpack when I go to work. I have some out like, at the front of my door just in case I'm leaving the house. Like, I always try to have my reusable bags. But when in the beginning of this, you know, when I was going to the grocery store, they weren't allowing people to bring their bags at some stores, or they were having you, usually having people use their plastic bags, or you could ask for paper, I guess. And that was really hard for me, because I had worked so hard to kind of get out of, you know, picking up the plastic bags when I'm in the store, and had tried, again, making all these accommodations, right, in my life. to have bags at the door in my backpack and in my car and all these places so I just don't forget it. So I had tried to train myself, and then I had to kind of take a step back. But some of the grocery stores near me allowed me to bring my own bag, but had to bag my stuff myself, which is never an issue for me. So I'm really grateful for that opportunity. That was awesome.
Yeah, and especially with the way Aldi's set up too, where they have like the countertops that they can easily clean, and then people can have some space to like load up and not be like blocking the rest of the line the way that traditional grocery stores do. I definitely prefer Aldi's setting as far as packing groceries compared to traditional grocery stores.
Of course. Of course. And then, so I also had tried to train myself into having my own utensils everywhere. So I would keep some in my backpack. I keep like a fork, you know, a little utensil set in my backpack, one at my desk at work, and now I have one in my car. And that was also, I actually think that that was a benefit of COVID, because I didn't have to worry about like wanting to use a utensil that like someone else had used, because I had my own already. So that was actually something that I think I was able to use COVID as a way to kind of say like, Simone, now is the time for you to make this your habit, right? Like, instead of trying to unlearn it, this is when you have no choice, right? You can ensure that your safety by making sure, and others as well, but making sure that you have your own utensils. So from now on, like myself and my husband, we always have our utensils. We always even bring like our own containers now, which we weren't doing before, but we had talked about, like when we go to like a family kind of outing sometimes, there would be like a potluck or something like that. Now, when we went to, it was like a family cookout recently. And so we had brought our food in our own containers and brought our utensils. We didn't have to worry about, you know, using the shared food. We had all of the things that we needed. So that was nice. I think that COVID allowed me the space to say, all right, Simone, now make sure you have your own utensils. Don't look back. This is the time to
now's my time to shine.
Exactly. Get this habit set in stone.
Yeah, I was very grateful for that too. I have actually I had my original set, but then I was given a set. So ACT, the Aquarium Conservation Team, does their little like gifts for the volunteers each year. And they gave me, it's funny enough, it's the same set of utensils I already had, but I had actually broken my spoon on the last set and they were getting a little older. And I was like, you know, it's probably time to replace these. And then that year they gave me that free set as a gift for being a volunteer. And I was like, yes.
Yes. Isn't that so funny how excited you get when you get something like that?
Yes. I was super stoked. And you know, I just popped my metal straw in that and it fit. Oh. And it, like you said, it goes everywhere. It's in my backpack that comes with me to work. And it goes with me when I go on travel. Not that I've gotten to travel much this
year. Yeah, right.
But yeah, I totally agree. Like the concept of, especially for those of us that did eat out, because, you know, I hate packing lunches. I'm such a lazy lunch packer, even though it's better and more economic. I really do just, I want more time to sleep and less time to worry about those things. So I don't pack lunches when I get up in the morning. At the most, I might chuck like ramen noodles in a Tupperware container so I can throw hot water over it and just be done with it. But I've eaten out a lot throughout the pandemic, more than I ever have in my entire life. And it's definitely been a lifesaver having those reusable utensils and being able to say like, no thanks when I go to the store.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, you want utensils? And it's like, no, I'm good. Thank you though.
Yes, exactly. And it's okay to say no thanks. You know, I think that that's something that some people like kind of struggle with adjusting to, like, oh, you know, I don't want to inconvenience the folks that work, you know, in the store, because they are used to always putting things in a plastic bag, right, or giving a utensil. And so I think it sometimes is even hard for them to adjust and be like, okay, you know, maybe I can ask, you know, would you like utensils or would you like a plastic bag? And I think a lot of businesses are doing a really great job with that right now. I just went somewhere recently and they asked, you know, do you want any utensils? Would you like a napkin? Do you want a bag? And I was like, wow, thank you for asking, you know, because that in itself is a sign that we are moving towards a little bit more sustainability just in our practices, something even as small as that. And I don't always think you need
a bag, if you are picking up like one thing, you probably don't need to put it in a bag. You know, like if you go to buy a card maybe from the store, you probably don't need a bag for that card. You can walk out with just that card, or put it in your purse or your backpack or what you already have, or just keep it in your hands. And so just remembering that it's all right to like say no thank you. It's all right to also like let them know that you appreciate them asking, and that, you know, that is helpful for them, so that they can continue to do that. Because I think we want to make sure that everyone knows that, you know, this is not something that people can do on their own, right? Like, we all have to be in it together. So giving them that reassurance, I think, is also super important.
100%. I agree. So my favorite place to go is a place in our neighborhood, Johnny Rad's.
Yeah.
I love eating there. And we eat there at least once a week. And it's gotten to the point to where when they get an order that has my partner's name on it, when we show up, unless it's somebody who doesn't know us, they know automatically not to put it in a bag, not to give us napkins, not to give us utensils, just to hand us our two boxes and right. and go. So they know. And that's something that we kind of had to train them to do, was
yes.
when we would show up to pick up things, especially if it wasn't already packed. If they're like, oh, let me go grab your food, I would say like, oh, and you can just hand me the food. I don't need a bag, utensils, or napkin. And that's something I had to practice saying to them. And
right.
they in turn have practiced doing that. And you know, even for those that don't know us sometimes, you know, I think maybe twice out of like the 30 times we've been there during the pandemic, people have given us bags without asking. But for the most part, for those that didn't know us, they would ask things like, do you want utensils in a bag? And, you know, that's given us the opportunity to say no and kind of reinforce that behavior with them.
Right.
And it's been great watching that kind of evolution throughout the pandemic of businesses, like you said,
mm-hmm.
kind of learning a little bit more, being better about being proactive and asking about these things.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And yeah, it makes me so happy to hear it too. You know, I love when a business asks those questions. I'm like, oh yes, you know. And it makes me really excited about continuing to support them too. And when you were just talking about your experience with Johnny Rides and kind of like training yourself to be comfortable speaking up, but also, you know, helping them along the journey, you know, when businesses are open to doing that and, you know, are making an effort, I think that that is really important. That makes me want to continue visiting there and spending my money there. I love that.
Absolutely. And I think Baltimore is heading in that direction anyway. I think that really big styrofoam ban we pushed has mm-hmm. really kind of like opened up businesses to the fact that there are a lot of conscientious consumers throughout Baltimore
yeah.
and at least giving them options. You don't necessarily have to not provide things at all, but at the very least just asking them first and giving them the option to say no and be more sustainable. That little bit goes a long way for people.
It does. It truly does. And it's really nice also. Baltimore actually is doing some really great things, you know, like how at the farmer's market, you can drop off your compost if you have compost. I love that.
Oh, yeah. That people underestimate Baltimore so much. You know, they focus so much on the negative aspects of the city. And I have to tell family and friends all the time who, you know, are the people who asked me when I first moved here if it was scary living in Baltimore. I've been like, no, this has been one of the best places I've ever lived. Like, I don't like Maryland that much. I'm going to be honest. This has not been my favorite place to live. But Baltimore has actually been one of my favorite places to live. I've learned a lot here and I've grown a lot here, more than I have in many places in my life. And the community is such a hardworking one. You know, people underestimate how much effort goes into people trying to make the streets safer, cleaner, a better place for families, you know, and mentoring children and giving them better opportunities. Like, it is absolutely incredible the amount of work that people do in the city, whether it's environmental, social, mm-hmm. economic, whatever it is. People are on the streets working really hard to make this place better. And despite all of the bad news that people hear, for every bit of bad news you probably hear, there's probably 10 really amazing and inspiring stories that got overlooked for that one bad story.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm from Baltimore. My family is from here, born and raised here. So I obviously love Baltimore dearly. and which is why I decided to, you know, come to the aquarium and do the work that I do with youth in the community, because like, I want to give back to kids who are just like me. Like I was those kids, like that was me. And so you're right that, you know, Baltimore is so special. And like, just when you look around the city, I know this is not about what we initially were talking about, but when you look around this city and you see like how artistic people are, like there's so many murals everywhere. I think that is beautiful, right? And a lot of times those murals are depicting like nature, which is fantastic. There are more and more green spaces popping up in communities. There are like those little, there's like in a lot of those green spaces or like little neighborhood parks, there's, you know, a spot where, you know, people can put books in so kids can come pick up books, which I think is fantastic to see that sense of community. I love seeing people, you know, like outside talking to their neighbors or sitting on their steps and talking to the neighbors around them. Those things really show me that Baltimore is so much more than what they show on the news and what people talk about. Baltimore is really about, you know, uplifting one another, being there for one another, supporting each other. There's so many local businesses and everyone wants to, you know, take care of one another. They share information about each other's businesses all the time. Baltimore is amazing, and I always want to make sure that any chance I get, I can talk the city up, because it really is. It's a great city. There's great food here, art. Like, we have some of the best, in a typical year, like the best large festivals, like the African American Heritage Festival. We had, you know, Artscape, obviously. So these are really huge things that are specific to Baltimore. And I don't want people to ever think anything less of this city.
My very first festival here was actually Bookfest that I volunteered for.
That was great.
I loved Bookfest. Not that I needed more books in my life, but even just creating that accessibility, it was amazing. Like, I was watching kids coming in with empty little wagons and carts and leaving with full ones. And I was just like, and they were coming up to me. And, you know, I was with the aquarium advertising. Oh gosh, what's our program? The Read to Reef program.
Yes.
And so I was helping push that. And of course, we were occasionally bringing out some of our program animals if the weather permitted it. And people were coming by asking questions, learning about the program. And it was just amazing. And I loved it so much because that was my first glimpse of Baltimore community. Because when I was initially living in downtown, you know, unfortunately, the downtown area isn't exactly connected to the rest of Baltimore. It is kind of this weird island of businesses and overpriced apartments.
And yes,
I was super grateful when I moved into Patterson Park, because one, it really kind of alleviated my pocketbook, but also it really helped me connect and engage more with the community that would be visiting the aquarium. And I've met more people and gotten more experience with the people who live around here, who have lived around here their whole lives like you, and have a completely different perception of the city than me. And I've loved it. I've loved every moment of it, and I wish that I had moved into this neighborhood first instead of making the mistake of living in downtown.
Yeah, that's the touristy area.
Yeah, it's such a nightmare, too, because I felt like it's one of those things where if you walk around any major city in a downtown area and you know, like, you look like you know where you're going, that is the cue for people to stop you and ask for directions. And I would be late to work sometimes just trying to show tourists around during the summertime, because they would come up to me lost, and I'd have, like, even when I tried to hide my aquarium uniform, just the fact that I was walking around
looked
like I knew where I was going, people would stop me in the streets and be like, "Do you know where this is?" And it's like,
"Of course.
Late for work."
Of course. I'm late for work. Yes. Exactly. Oh, man. So I'm with you. I think that there are so many opportunities, and I loved it. And I'm glad that we are still able to, you know, at least try to keep up with our low-waste lifestyle. Definitely not there at all. I am not where I want to be, but I'm really happy with, you know, the adjustments that I have made so far. Like, we cut out paper towels in our home. We don't have any paper towels. We don't do any plastic water bottles or anything. We have like a Brita filter that we normally just use and keep refilling up our reusable water bottle with that. And then, of course, like I was talking about, utensils and bags. And so I think that those are like just right now, those are the ones that I'm prioritizing. I'm going to start looking at, I'm in the process at least of looking at where I get my clothes. And I haven't bought clothes in so long. So this is, I haven't bought clothes in a very long time. And so I'm in a place now where I do want to purchase clothes. I want to make sure that I'm, you know, getting them from a business. If I am not going to buy secondhand, I want to make sure that I'm getting it from a business that has like ethical practices and like how they make their clothing, and you know, the workers, of course, that are making the clothes that I'm buying. So I've been doing more research on that. That's my next step.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I remember when I did my, like, I, of course, Plastic Free July was a little bit different this year compared to previous years.
And, yeah.
But I mean, I'm still working on my last Plastic Free July, because I do remember, you know, I did my waste audit, and we're pretty good about a lot of the same things. We have a filter on our sink, so we just get water straight from our sink, and we have our reusable bags / backpacks, our reusable utensils. We are close to eliminating paper towels. I do have like the little cellulose cloths and things like that.
Yes.
Replace paper towels. Clothing's usually not too big for me because I do rarely buy it. Like I have a lot of with the exception of the aquarium shirts I'm given for every Masonville Cove.
Yes.
I do. That's always my new t-shirt of the entire year is my Masonville Cove shirt from the aquarium that I now have like 4 or 5 of now.
Right.
But my biggest thing was food waste. And of course, you know, food comes in a lot of packages. And while I was super concerned with my cardboard stuff, because I take that to the aquarium to give to Animals for Enrichment, my big concern was, of course, anything that comes in a plastic container.
Yeah.
And even just exploring how to get rid of that is really hard because,
oh yeah,
you know, one thing was, okay, well, I like to snack on popcorn a lot. So rather than, you know, buying a plastic bag of popcorn, I'll just buy popcorn kernels. But almost all the things that I could buy popcorn kernels in still came in plastic.
Yeah, right. I was like,
oh no. So that's been my biggest challenge, is reducing my food waste plastics and trying to be less, like, I love to cook. I just hate to prep.
Mm-hmm.
So like all those people who do like the food prepping and they like make all these pre-made meals, put them in Tupperware and set them up for the week. I don't have the mentality for that. Like, I am definitely like, I like to make something fresh and eat it fresh.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of making homemade potato chips, but I don't want to make like enough potato chips to last me for like a week.
Right. Yeah. I'm with you on that. So I definitely agree. That's one of my areas too. You know, trying to, food waste is a huge one, and we have to buy items that are gluten-free and dairy-free. So that also makes it even a bit harder because some of those items don't have like a glass alternative or anything. Like they only come in plastic. So it's been really interesting trying to figure out, you know, how we can make adjustments, or, you know, we might try to buy things in bulk. That's definitely one thing we started looking at, like, you know, buying some of our like spices in bulk. So we go to Sprouts and we'll buy the spices and then just refill the glass spice containers that we've had from the past when we were buying them. We just refilled them. So that has actually worked really well. And it's actually pretty cheap, like cheaper than when we were buying the seasonings, like off the rack in this grocery store.
Oh, that's cool. See, and that's the thing, is I need to explore more grocery stores because, you know, for us, the closest ones we have are some of the big chains like Aldi and Safeway and,
yeah,
you know, Shoppers and Target and things like that. Like,
yeah,
I don't often get to go out and pursue some of the either smaller chains or local chains very often, largely because I don't own a car, because
right,
I live in a city where I can bike everywhere.
Yeah.
So I definitely need to explore more of those options, because I originally was going to try that. What was it? There was going to be that subscription thing that came out like a few years ago. I think, I don't remember if it was Amazon or some other major company that was going to try to start it, but it was supposed to be some big startup where it was like, they were going to deliver you food and things in reusable glass containers and things like that. And then when you were done, you were supposed to send the package back.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be that kind of subscription. And I was like, that's cool. Maybe I can try that out and see how that works for my food waste. And then I'm not sure it ever got off the ground because they went into like their testing phase. And then I never got an email again about it. And I'm just like, well, I guess I need to just keep focusing on doing it by myself.
Exactly. Right. Keep doing. You only can depend on you. Mm-hmm. I already know.
Yeah, I have been thinking about, you know, you mentioned clothing. I do need to kind of redo my wardrobe a little bit because,
yeah,
like I said, a lot of these shirts are years old and some of it shows. And I've definitely gotten more into different kinds of clothing, you know.
Yeah.
any person, like a lot of us change over time. And
yes.
I own more leggings now than I own pants. But the leggings I like are pretty pricey. So my favorite leggings are PopFit leggings, which come with
okay.
And I'll have to see if I can find the website again. There's a website that is very much a thrift store website. It's like people bought stuff. They
yeah.
don't like it, doesn't fit, or they don't want it anymore. And they're reselling it. And I'm like, I found somebody who sells these PopFit leggings. And
ooh.
I was like, oh, heck yeah. So instead of paying like $20-$30 for a pair, I'm paying like $10 or $15 for a pair.
Nice.
Yeah. And so, you know, instead of owning like my two original pair, I now have like 7 pairs.
Yes.
So I'm definitely trying to get more into some of that thrift shopping. But of course, I don't want to buy thrifty clothes that are going to fall apart in a year. I want thrifty clothes that are
right.
like new that will still last me 4 years so that I don't have to worry about buying new clothes all the time.
Right. I'm with you. I totally agree with that.
I know. And then I guess probably the most important sustainable most choice most people can make this year is, of course, voting. Like, that's mm-hmm. definitely something that I'm always encouraging people to do during an election year, is that participation means a lot. You know, choosing people or telling representatives that their environmental stances matter mm-hmm. is a really big and important part of our engagement with not just, you know, our government, but also with our environment.
For sure. Yes. And I'm glad you brought that up because there are lots of ways that you can, in addition to voting, so voting number one, for sure. But in addition to that, right, there's so many ways that you can advocate for the environment by like writing to your local representatives. And so, and we were talking a little bit about how, you know, there was a huge push for like styrofoam ban here, the plastic bag ban here. That was like done by youth in Baltimore, and they, you know, advocated in so many different ways, like through social media, through letters, through phone calls, through protests, through, you know, like testimonies. So there are so many ways that you can advocate for the environment. So we would definitely encourage everyone to do those things.
Absolutely. And one thing that I did 2 years ago when I was still living in the apartment in downtown, I was able to rent this space in my apartment complex for a party, and I had a Halloween party. And part of my Halloween party, because 2 years ago it was an election year, uh-huh. I actually pre-typed up letters
yes.
for representatives talking about environmental things. And I was like, you can either choose to sign these pre-made copies and I will mail them all on your behalf, or, you know, here is a recommended way to write a letter, because mm-hmm. of course, you know, it's one of those things where you're not going to have a productive conversation if you just attack people. So I wrote up like a guideline of how to write a really good way, say, you know, introduce yourself, introduce the topic, talk about what it means to you, say what you would like, you know, talk about what you would like to see changed, and make, you know, recommendations to this person that you think will reflect better what you hope to change and things like that. And just wrote up this whole guideline of how to write the letter so that if people wanted to handwrite a letter instead, they could do that. And that was literally part of my party, like something that you could do mm-hmm. in addition to all the fun party activities was you could sign a letter advocating for better environmental change from, you know, representatives of Maryland.
Right.
As residents of Maryland. So that's, it sounds really geeky, but it was such a simple thing because literally all people had to do was put their signature on it. I had envelopes with addresses and stamps already on them. I was ready to just take those and send them to this, it was a senator in particular that we were writing to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was such a simple thing to do. It didn't cost me a lot of effort or money to do. And it only cost people a couple seconds of their time if they chose to just throw a signature on there.
Right. That doesn't sound geeky at all to me. That sounds perfect. And I might throw that idea for any, I don't know what event I would be holding in these day and ages. But if I were to have anything, guess what? I might be doing that. So I love it. Thank you for that idea.
Yeah, I tried to host like sustainable Halloween parties. So I tried to like reduce my waste by having like all reusable stuff at the party.
Mm-hmm.
And I had different games that were mostly wildlife themed, but then I still wanted to be like, you know, a lot of the people here are environmental educators and they talk about sustainability. So I wanted to give them the ability to do something that I would hopefully think they thought was cool.
Yeah.
And so I set up, I had a coloring station with coloring pages of animals, and right next to it, it was the sign the letter to a senator station.
Wow. I love that.
Yep, people can learn just how nerdy some of us in the wildlife conservation are.
I know, right?
I'm so sad too, because that's the one thing I kind of lost. Like, as much as I love no longer living in that apartment in downtown, you know, I lost that really cool space that I would rent every year for this party, because it wasn't a big space. I could only have like 20 people there, but to be honest, you know, those of us doing wildlife education and stuff at the aquarium aren't necessarily like a huge number of people.
Yeah.
So inviting 20 people wasn't a big deal. And it was a lot of fun because we did it sort of like potluck style. And you know, every year I would challenge myself to come up with like cooler and more fun activities. And it as I did it, I learned more and more about, you know, just how nerdy our people are. And, you know, that's what kind of inspired me to take the route of like the you know, we talk all the time about, you know, writing letters to representatives, but I'm like, how many of our people actually do it? And so that's
right.
Why I did it was, it was definitely a practice what you preach kind of moment for me.
I love it. That's it. Put your money where your mouth is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I definitely need to do more of that in the future too, because I feel like now after everything that's happened with COVID and everything else that's been happening this year, it feels more important than ever to start doing a lot more of our practice what we preach with people who may not necessarily consider themselves wildlife conservationists and may think that it's a very, you know, strange and exotic term, but it's something that literally anybody can do and participate in. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort to do simple things every day.
Yes. Wow. That was a good one. I love when like, I love when people like round out a conversation with like such a really good, great way to close out that part. Like that's a quote that I would definitely add somewhere.
Well, I mean, it's literally our jobs, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, I feel like it comes naturally to us because it is our job, not just to spout off scientific facts, but to make sure that we're really hitting home these messages and making sure that people understand that we never want to gatekeep sustainability. That's been the biggest issue with the sustainability movement, is it's been, you know, a gatekeeping issue. Like anytime somebody sticks eco or sustainable on something, it becomes expensive. It becomes more expensive. And it's very much like, it feels like it's this unattainable, like unless you're this middle class or upper class, like yoga doing,
it does
Tesla driving person, that you can't be sustainable. And it couldn't be further from the truth. Sustainable actions are very affordable, very economic. And if anything, the people who have the ability to be the most sustainable are the people who live in very poor conditions.
Yeah. And they're usually already doing things that are like demonstrating sustainability. Like they're already doing those things. They just maybe don't know or were ever told like, oh, you know that action that you're taking, you know that that's actually like reducing the impact on our environment. And like, if we can explain it like that, you know, I think that people would be even more excited about saying that they care for the environment and that they're taking steps to protect it, because usually they just aren't aware that that's what it really is, you know?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And for them, really, I mean, I feel like for people who already are, whether intentionally or unintentionally practicing it, it really does become... It is a lot of little simple things we can do, but really the simplest thing that it does come down to is a lot of that civic engagement, because especially here in Baltimore, we have some things that we're struggling with, like the wheel abrader and things like that, where they're burning trash for electricity. It's not sustainable, despite what they say. It's causing all these toxic fumes to waft into some of our most vulnerable communities and causing people to have, you know, respiratory issues and heart issues, and then having something like COVID that can kill people with respiratory issues, you know, suddenly we had all these compounding issues affecting very vulnerable communities in Baltimore, and suddenly sustainability and environmentalism wasn't just something as simple as not using plastic bags at the grocery store. It does become civic engagement because we're talking about not just protecting the environment, but protecting people's lives in this case.
Right. Totally. I'm definitely 100% with you on that. We talk about that all the time, like those adverts, like those impacts to people's health, you know, in relation to our environment. And the Wheeler Breeder is definitely one of the biggest examples here in Baltimore. So yes, I'm so glad you brought that up.
I hate that thing so much. Like, I didn't realize what it was when I first came to Baltimore. I had no clue. Like, it was just that big chimney stack. And I'm like, there's lots of chimney stacks. And I'd see them, you know, putting out God knows what into the environment. And I'm just like, okay, so I'm living in a bit of an industrial area. It's not going to be the best for my health. But then I learned what the Wheeler Breeder was and how much worse it is than all the other, like, emissions. Because I forget what it was. I read some statistic where it's like compared to like other industrial emitters, like the Wheeler Breeder was like worse than the next six biggest emitters combined in the state of really bad. And I was just like, wow, they're literally just killing people in Baltimore for what? I get that landfills are an issue. I understand that our production of trash is an issue. I do not believe for a moment that we should kill people to get rid of trash, though.
No, not at all.
That is never a good take.
Not at all.
And my heart really goes out to those communities, too. I can't imagine how bad COVID's been for people that already had like all of these pre-existing conditions of asthma, lung disease, and stuff like that. We basically created a ticking time bomb with the Wheeler Breeder and all the health effects it had on the community. And then having COVID come through and just wipe through some of these communities, because even if these people survive it, the damage done to a lot of people's lungs from COVID is going to be, you know, lasting for the rest of their lives. And it's going to make them, again, even more susceptible to more future impacts to their health. And it's awful to think about what's been done to these people and how much it really needs to change, like right now.
Right. Yes. Wholeheartedly agree.
And that's why people like you are so important. You know, I would never have thought for many, many years of my life, I would have never thought I want to go be an environmental advocate in Baltimore to protect the vulnerable people of Baltimore. You know, I am very much like, you know, I came into this field being like, I want to do more with wildlife and telling people that they should protect wildlife. And now as I've learned more and I've grown more, I have kind of started heading in that direction of, it's really important that we protect the environment, because it's not just about protecting wildlife anymore. It's also about making sure that people don't literally die from our poor environmental choices.
Yeah. And that's why it is so important that we, like, I don't know why it's hard for people to understand that, you know, caring about the environment also includes caring about people. And, you know, I don't know why that's difficult for people to understand, but I feel like we're always having to talk about that.
Yeah, and it really just highlights the importance of, you know, I get that big SciComm people like, you know, Bill Nye are important.
Oh, yeah.
But I find that the people I think doing the most important work are the people living in the cities, interacting and engaging directly with communities, because people can see that you're a real person. You can engage with them like they're real people and create connections that a big national name brand like Science Communicator can't have. So I think the people doing some of the most important work for protecting not just the environment, but protecting people are people like you, because you are engaging directly into the community. And even better, you're directly engaging the future of the community by doing all this youth outreach. And, you know, the work that you do is some of the most important stuff that we can do in protecting Baltimore, is making sure that not just the adults who can vote know this, but also the kids who are going to grow up and vote know this. And even better, I think, and this is just a personal opinion, I think parents are more receptive to things that their kids bring home
Oh yeah.
about than getting it from us sometimes.
Yes, I totally agree with that, which is why we normally try to like equip our students with the tools that they need to convey those messages effectively, because parents are more receptive when they hear from their student. And think about, their child. It happens all the time. So we definitely believe that. And it's nice because the kids can work together, right, at pushing those initiatives, like we were talking about with the plastic bag ban. You know, like that was a youth-led, like that effort was youth-led. That is amazing. That is like absolutely amazing. And I think that you're right, you know, now is the time for us to prepare our students so that they can take actions when they're adults, because they're going to be more environmentally literate, right? But also, like, they can take actions now, too. And that I think, means so much.
Absolutely. And it's very exciting, because I've seen more and more of that the longer I've lived in Baltimore. Like when I first arrived in 2016, you know, we were having, for the next couple of years, we had like the big climate marches and the women's march and things like that. But, you know, as some of those things have died down a bit, in its place, I've seen things like, you know, the youth-led protests for, you know, banning the plastic bags and styrofoam, and even the straws, even if that one didn't go through. And even just this year alone, too, like the very first Black Lives Matter protest I went to was literally organized and led by teenage girls, Black teenage girls from Baltimore. You know, it's absolutely inspiring to see that, you know, that next generation is very conscientious of the world that they're going to inherit. And while it is unfortunate in some ways, because it's definitely one of those things where it's like, I do wish that kids could just be kids. At the same time, these kids are absolutely just leaders that I want to see in the future. They're leaders I wish I had right now. Like, I wish I didn't have to wait for them to grow up. I want to see these kids leading things now, because it is absolutely phenomenal watching them see all of the hardship and strife that has come before them, that's happening now, and that they're going to have to deal with in the future. And instead of feeling demoralized and feeling helpless in the face of it, they are taking action. They are taking a stand. They are incredibly brave and selfless people. And they are definitely more of what this world needs. And I'm so excited that people like you can help facilitate that, to help, you know, empower these kids to do more and be more in their future. It's absolutely amazing.
Thank you for those kind words. Seriously, that's really, that means a lot. I'm glad. I mean, it's hard work, because it takes a lot, but I'm always so excited, right? And like, you know, the experience is different with every single kid, every group, you know, every school. So I'm always looking forward to doing it.
That's perfect. It's so great. And I think more people need to understand that too. And I think that's kind of the importance of highlighting, you know, again, like the work of the people who are doing like the grunt work on the ground, basically, like those of us that are on the front lines of cities and communities who are really trying to do more of this outreach, because I understand the importance of being a really big influencer, having a huge platform and stuff like that, but I do feel like the bigger you get, the less connected you get to people. And I feel like we need a blend of both. We do need those big trusted names out there, you know, teaching people and engaging them and telling them the importance of these issues. But then people also need the members of their community who are also going to come out and reinforce that and give them a real human face to engage with somebody, and have that person in turn see them as human too, and understand that they're not perfect and they have needs, and it can't be met with one generic message. We have to very carefully tailor sometimes our messages and our goals to different communities and even just households.
Oh yeah, definitely. And that's why I was saying, you know, like it's completely different for each person, right? You know, like what we might do or how I might engage with, you know, one group of students might be completely different than how we do it with another. And so that's why I work really hard to like ask them, you know, like what they need, what they're looking for, like get a baseline for even, you know, how they feel from the beginning before I just go in and try to, you know, bring them along the journey. So it's always really great to work with someone and not try to like talk to them. Like you want to talk to them, you want to talk with them and listen to where they're coming from, but they also be able to give them feedback on how their experience, you know, can be used to help us, like being the world, like us not just being, you know, the National Aquarium, like to help us and our environment. And so that we aren't just, you know, telling them what to do and they're feeling like you, like gatekeeping, like you exactly what you were talking about. We don't want to do that. So it's really best that we work with the audience instead of us just directing them. And normally they're super receptive, right? Everyone is always like, oh, you know, I never thought about it like that. Or, you know, letting people know the changes that they can make or just helping them to identify the things that they already do, like we talked about, you know, previously, making sure that people know that you are already taking these actions, you know? So let's continue to do that. But what's the next step for you after this? You know, same way that you did, you know, an audit for yourself and was able to say, okay, these are the areas that I need to work on. I know that there were areas, you know, that I wanted to work on and I've kind of mastered some of them, but now I want to move on to this next level. And so exactly what we've been talking about is what we want to do with our audience.
And that's perfect too. And I think that really needs to become like, you know, that universal approach. And it's definitely something that I've gotten better at since I came to this aquarium, because I first started learning about conservation messaging when I was in the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And when I came here, it was my first time being paid to do it. And it really helped me broaden my approach. Like I remember one experience I had where a mom came in and we were talking about, it was actually around the Halloween time again. This seems to be when most of my best messages come out. I'm always inspired during the spooky season, but her son had a birthday in October. And we were talking about reducing trash because, you know, one of the things we talked about was, you know, everybody buying all these candies and all these wrappers and stuff. And it's like, you know, what can we do to help people be more sustainable during a season when we produce so much trash? And she was talking about her son's birthday. And, you know, she's like, I don't feel like it's reasonable for me to have to provide all of my own plates and utensils for kids to have birthday cake on because suddenly I have all these dishes and all this work to do. And I was like, well, why don't you talk to the parents of the kids who RSVP and ask them if they can bring their own plates and utensils to the party? And then suddenly they're responsible for that stuff. They're responsible for keeping track of it. It would suck, of course, if they left them behind, but suddenly everybody's taking home their dirty plates and utensils and you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to do all these dishes and it helps you eliminate some of that waste. And she was like, you know what? I might have to try that, you know?
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, exactly.
And it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you can't just say, here's a solution to all your problems. Take this home with you. It's more of, you know, what's stopping you? What are the barriers and obstacles that you're facing and how can I help you overcome? What can I give you as tools, resources, knowledge to overcome those obstacles?
Right. Yes. The work will never stop, but it's always fun and exciting. You know, like the work is going to be hard. The work will be constant, but it's always different and it's always rewarding, right? It's fun. And that's what I love the most about what we do.
Absolutely. And I miss it. Like part of me hates like that I quit my paid job to focus on school. But at the same time, like I can't go anywhere in my paid job until I finish my schoolwork. So
yeah,
you know, I still love the volunteer work I do, but I definitely miss the engagement. Like I don't get to engage people as much as I used to, especially since we're not doing animal programs right now.
Right.
You know, I've lost almost all engagement with our guests right now. And it's probably the most frustrating part about this is as much as I am an introvert and a hermit, I do find educating people about wildlife and teaching them ways to engage in nature that's safe and sustainable for them and for wildlife is the most gratifying thing I feel like I can do with my time and my energy. And I'm anxious to get back into that kind of work. I miss it.
Yeah, I do miss it too, but not even a but. I miss it as well.
there's no but. I miss my work.
Yep, there's no but.
I'm 100% there with you. Well, I really appreciate you coming and talking about this and, you know, also being an outlet for me to voice some of my frustrations about it. because I know that you can relate to it so much. Like,
yes,
you're the only person I've done this with who is literally in the same boat as me.
Right. You know, so I definitely relate and I feel everything that you feel. So that's why I was like about to, you know, I was trying to come up with something to say that's like, oh, look at the bright side. I was like, yeah, no, I don't have anything else to say. I feel the same exact way.
But that is kind of the bright side though, is, you know, it's kind of been a bit of the theme of the pandemic is, you know, we're in this together. And to some extent, I argue with it, but at the same extent, there are definitely moments where it's like, yeah, we're all in this boat and we're all just trying to, you know, paddle up a creek without any paddle.
Yeah, right.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I'm sorry that yours came in a little late, but I still think it's good, especially like with everything that's going on this year, like all of it's relevant. All of it needs to be said and heard. And
No, it's fine. I mean, I know that we also, it's so funny because we were trying to like, oh, we said sharks, right? And then when we got on the call today, we were like, well, we're going to talk about this. And then we ended up talking about things that were not necessarily what we said we would talk about. But I think that that's really cool, right? It just kind of naturally went its own direction, which is fine. I have no issue. I'm excited about it.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, especially with some of my other takeovers, like I'm totally fine with them taking that natural course because, you know, one, I do think it's more enjoyable to listen to. And two, it definitely sometimes helps bring to light different things. It's kind of like how a lot more sciences are being mixed more, like you have more people doing things. Like today I posted my podcast episode with Dr. Simone Alexander and she does biophysics. Mm-hmm. So it's not just physics, it's biophysics. So it's interdisciplinary. And I really do think that when we approach issues, we have to be more holistic and make sure that we're taking in different points of view and not just looking at it in this very strict, tight box that you can't really like it's environmentalism. You can't talk about anything else. Well, I can talk about a lot of things when I talk about environmentalism. I can talk about income inequality. I can talk about racial inequality. I can talk about a lot of things when it comes to environmentalism. It's not strictly about saving the animals. Sometimes, right. I have to talk about it economically because there's some people that don't care about the environment unless they're making more money.
Yep.
I have to take all those perspectives into account. So I'm totally fine when people go off on tangents because it's usually still relevant.
Heck yeah. Because we know that, you know, environmentalism is intersectional. Like we know this. Oh, we fully recognize that. And so there's no way that we could talk about, we can only limit it to the animals. Like we would never make any progress, right? We would never make any progress.
Nope. Yeah, I totally agree. So I'm extremely grateful. I think that it's all good stuff. And I definitely am grateful that you had time to do this today because every person who's done this has been different and I've learned so much from them, not just about themselves, but also about, you know, the things we've discussed. And it also helps too. Like it's so inspiring for me to hear about the work you do with these kids because, you know, other people may not see it, but I get to see the direct results of a lot of that work.
Right. And right.
I love it. I love watching our work and our efforts being put into practice, especially by children, because it's magical. There's no other word for it. It's magical seeing these kids being leaders and being amazing. I'm so jealous of them. They're gonna have such an amazing future. And, you know, it's funny because I think every generation grows up with parents talking about them being smarter than everybody else and being this and being that. But, you know, that's every generation. And I do feel like a lot of us as like millennials were raised with that perspective. But, you know, compared to how my generation grew up and compared to how I'm seeing this generation grow up, Gen Z is amazing.
Oh, yeah, they are.
I don't care what anybody says. Gen Z is amazing and they're going to do amazing things. And I'm really excited for the future that they can help us build because they really are energetic, they're inspired, they're driven, and they want change. And I want to see them change the world. It's going to be amazing.
I'm with you. I'm excited too. They inspire me. They push me to be better. So I'm really looking forward to seeing all the great things that they do.
Absolutely. Well, I will
thank you.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I'll let you go enjoy the rest of your the rest of your Wednesday.
Thanks. I have so many meetings. And then I have a meeting that was starting at 1:30, but it's fine. I told them like I'll be late. It'll be okay.
I'm doing fun stuff for me right now.
Fine. You'll be fine without me. So whatever. But I'm gonna go do that. But I'm so excited. Thank you, of course, for having me. And let me know if you see any cool things when you go to volunteer.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's right. I need to send you some pictures. There's
definitely
some pictures I need to send you.
Yes, let me know.
Absolutely. And we'll definitely have to do future episodes. I especially with sharks too. I definitely want to do more with sand tigers because I've had more experience with them than any other shark. And I want to talk about them, and you would be the perfect person to talk to about that.
Heck yeah. Oh, I love the raggies. I would love to talk about raggies whenever you're ready.
Awesome. Well, you have good luck with your meetings. I hope they're I hope they're not too bad, that they're enjoyable, and I will talk to you later.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.